I just want to say about 4 years ago, I got a phone call, and I was pretty much in the depths of my addiction and alcoholism. And a good friend of mine called me from that I knew and ran with in college. And he said, what you been doing? And I said, well, you know, not much. And this guy had a sense that I was sick, and I knew I was sick, and I knew I needed help. And this guy, in his sixth sense, knew to call me and took me to a meeting, and I've been clean ever since. And that guy is our speaker tonight, Mr. Barnes. Bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. And tonight we are honored to have Bill Barnes speak to us. Tonight is his birthday, 15 years in the program. Yay!
Good evening, everyone. Thanks, Tim, for inviting me. And my sobriety day is today, 15 years ago. I'm kind of shocked by that, and I'm also very happy about it. In the big book it talks about, we talk about what it was like, what I did, and what it's like now. And I'm going to attempt to do that. I'm just going to spend a very little time on what it was like. I'm going to qualify myself. Before I do, I've got a little joke I tell, and it goes like this. There were three spiritual men and their wives in a Winnebago, and they were going to Florida for vacation, and they get hit by a train, and they're all killed, and they are floating up to heaven to get admitted into heaven. And the first spiritual guy goes up to St. Pete. He says, you know, I've been a good spiritual life man all my life. Am I going to get into heaven? And St. Pete says, well, what's your name? And the guy tells him his name, and he says, well, let me find you on the list. So he looks down the list and says, nope, can't let you in. He said, well, why not? He said, well, because while you're on earth, you coveted alcohol so much, you even married a wife named Sherry. Well, the second man came up, said, I've been a good spiritual man all my life. Am I going to get into heaven? St. Pete said, what's your name? And he looked down the list and said, nope, can't let you in either. He said, well, why not? He said, well, because while you're on earth, you coveted money so much, you even married a wife named Penny. Well, the third spiritual man and his wife looked at each other, having heard what was said before, and the man said to his wife, well, come on, Fanny, I don't think we got a chance. I tell that joke, and it's a tacky joke, but I tell it because, you know, my life was revolved around sex, alcohol and drugs, and money before I got here. I did thought with every bit of my being to find that stuff, and I thought it was going to make me happy, and that's changed dramatically since I've gotten here. Again, I'm going to spend very little time on what it was like, and I had, as a child, I look back at this stuff now, and I can see clearly what I could not see when I was young and when I was going through all this stuff. I firmly believe that I did the best I could do with what I had to work with as a young man, a kid, young adult, and then an adult. I just didn't have the tools that this program has given me to deal with the feelings of life. So I pretty much bounced off of life with all my character defects, just bouncing off of it, doing the best I could, but I did a really bad job of it and didn't understand the value of character qualities in that. As a kid, I look back and I remember being in the neighborhood not feeling a part of. I couldn't say to myself, I don't feel a part of. I just knew I didn't feel quite right, and felt that way all the way up through high school and first discovered alcohol and other things. When I was about 17, 18, I was a late bloomer. And one of the guys at my high school asked me if I wanted to go to the park and drink one night in Chastain Park, for those of you all who remember that place. And I immediately said yes and felt good that I was asked to do anything to be part of something socially. So I started going up there and hanging out and being a part of. And I became part of this clique, and it happened to be people that grew their hair long. And that's the people that I identified with. I look back over my two brothers. They identified with other people. I identified with people with long hair that were doing things that seemed to give me some relief. So I would get go up and drink and do other things, and I had an immediate sense of belonging, which is what I'd wanted all my life. I talk about when I walked in the door of AA, I thought it was to learn how to quit drinking. But really what I was after, I learned as I've been here for a while, is that I really wanted to learn how, yes, to learn how to quit drinking, but also to learn how to be comfortable in my own skin and not want to drink. And that's been a real the gift that this program has given me. And I'll get more into that later. So I then went to college, University of Georgia, and tried my first other illegal substances up there. And my addiction progressed. I don't think I'd crossed that line. You know, I can't look back over and say I became an alcoholic at some point. But I drank alcoholically kind of all through. I would binge all through my early teens up through my 20s and then into my 30s. And I used relationships to change the way I feel. And that's one of the things I've seen that I had done early in recovery and I see other people doing now is we get off the alcohol and the drugs and we find other ways to change the way we feel that are not healthy for us. And I used relationships. I look back on it and I'm amazed at the chronology of it. I've been married four times now. This is my fourth marriage. I'm happily married for over 10 years now, but on the three previous marriages, I would meet somebody, I would date him a year, I would then get married, and exactly 3 years later, the first two I would divorce because I knew I couldn't continue to live the lifestyle I was living, and it was easier to leave somebody than it was to be left. So I would leave. I would think, you know, I'm not going to find anybody else. I'd meet somebody, I'd date him a year. I'd marry him exactly 3 years later. In the last year, I would have behaviors. I'd be out there binging and knew I couldn't continue that lifestyle and stay married, so I left him. Well, the third one was a reasonably healthy human being, and I met her, dated her for a year. We got married, and in the third year, at the end of the third year, I was heavily into my addiction, my drinking, and here was my modus operandi. I would go out on a bender, and I would stay out however long I was gone, a day or two or three, and I would purposely stay out late enough in the morning so she would go to work, so I could then come home and try to sleep it off during the day, and she would come home, and all I was looking to hear from her was, "Are you leaving me?" And she never said, "Bill, if you do this again, I'm leaving you." But I look back over that history of that now, and I realize she said plenty of other things that if I was present of mind, I would have heard it over that last year, that it was, she was saying just that, but she didn't say that. So it was my 40th birthday, and what do alcoholics do on their 40th birthday? You know? Let's go. And so I went out, and I was gone for a couple of days, and I did the typical stay out all night. You know, come home about 10, and I slept it off. And I was sitting there on the sofa when she came home that day, and she came home and she said, "I've been to see a counselor, and I still love you, but I'm not in love with you anymore, and I want a divorce." And that was it. And as y'all all know, it's a lot easier to leave somebody than it is to be left. And I was not prepared for it. So I knew I had a problem because, back up just a bit, in 1982. I had been working in my chosen field and I'd had a real addiction problem and I woke up after a bender out one night and there was my boss and my wife at the time standing over me saying, either you go to treatment or you lost your job. And that was the carrot I needed to go. So I went through a 28-day program. And I want to talk a little bit about treatment programs here for a minute. Treatment programs are a wonderful thing that if people are able to get into them, but they're, and I can look at issues and I can learn things about myself and I can get information about the disease of addiction that I didn't have and I can work on issues, but treatment centers are just a place for me to get started, to go to meetings, to find that competent sponsor, to learn to work the steps, and I'll go into more of that later. But so I went into a 28 program, which was not enough for me. I think the best I can recollect, they exposed me to two or three meetings, AA meetings, which of course I didn't identify with at all. And when I got out, I stayed clean for probably 60 days because I had no tools at all to stay clean. So I was back out there for 10 more years. So back to my wife had left me, and I knew I had a problem because I'd gone through treatment 10 years earlier. I remember even saying to her, when she said I want a divorce, I said, "Well, I'm an alcoholic. I need help." She says, "Well, I'm glad you know you need help." But I had already killed it by then. So she left, and I stayed in the condo I was living, and I stayed clean for a week, and had no tools to deal with the feelings I was going through. And so I woke up like any good alcoholic and said, "What do I need to stay clean for? She's gone. She's not coming back." So I proceeded to flat burn it, slap down. I had a little bit of money, and I had credit cards. Imagine that. And so I got on I'm very grandiose, you know, wanting to buy friendships. So I get on a plane, and I go to the Caribbean, and I go to the Bahamas, and then Jamaica, a total of 48 straight days, didn't sleep at all, just burning money up, trying to buy friendships, you know, doing all the crazy stuff we do when I'm burning it down. I finally ran out of money. Thank God, couldn't get any more money. I borrowed everything I could get. And by the grace of God, I had a plane ticket left, a return plane ticket. And so I called my family, which I still had, and some friends met me at the airport, and I ended up in a treatment center called MAR. Some of y'all know that, this treatment center. World-class treatment center. Can't say enough good things about it. It saved my life. I think that my recovery started when I was in that treatment program. I had been there about 20, 30 days, my best recollection, and I look at this point, and I think this night was when my recovery truly started. I was sitting in for those of you all familiar with treatment centers, they have a twice weekly, bring all the people in the community together. It was two apartments, 10 guys, and they would have an issues meeting, you know, Jimmy stealing my baloney, and, you know, all those kinds of things, you know, Jimmy smoking inside, and, you know, those kinds of things. And they have a counselor come in, and I'd been through several of these, and I was just tired of them talking about me. So I didn't want to talk about me anymore. So I did everything I knew how to do to have them not talk about me for that one meeting. I kissed ass. I was as nice as I knew how to be to everybody. I gave people rides. I did everything I could. So the day comes, I think it was a Wednesday, and we're sitting in around the circle, and I'm thinking, I'm feeling pretty good. They ain't going to talk about me. Well, they start on one side of the room, and every single person starts jumping in my stuff. And I'm not hearing a word they're saying. I'm just getting angrier and angrier and angrier. And finally gets around to the counselor, and I'm thinking maybe he'll save me. Nope, he jumped in my stuff too. I stood up, and I said, "F this." And I walked out of the apartment, walked into the next door apartment where I was living, walked into my bedroom, opened the closet, pulled my suitcase out, threw it on the bed, and said to myself, "I don't have anywhere to go." And I'm really glad I didn't. I then sat on the steps until the meeting was over, and the counselor didn't ask me to leave, which I'm grateful for. And this is when my recovery started. I then pulled that night each person in my community out on the balcony one at a time. And I asked them, and I was able to really start listening to them. I became, the phrase I love is, I became willing to hear what I didn't want to hear about me. Before recovery, if you were to point out something to me, you might want to look at this, I would make it about you. I'd say, "Why don't you look at your own damn self?" Or, "It takes one to know one." And I wasn't even willing to look inside and see if what you were saying about me was right. And that night, they all basically, even though it was just one at a time, they all basically told me the same stuff. And I was able to hear it. And I immediately started making changes based on that, and things immediately started getting better. Well, at that treatment center, I discovered a meeting called the Log Cabin. And I feel very blessed that the very first meeting I went to, it was like 2 weeks in this treatment center, and I got exposed to this place that I immediately identified. There were people there with multiple years of clean time that were happy. I just really was attracted to this thing. And when I talk about meetings with folks, if you're not happy if I'm not happy with the meetings I'm going to, if I'm not connecting, there are tons of meetings here in this city. Now, the suggestion is to go find a meeting that you like or meetings that you like and find that one person that you're going to trust. You're going to choose to trust. If I go to enough meetings, and if I ask around in a meeting, I can find out who the good sponsors are. I can find out who's doing the deal, who's sponsoring a bunch of guys, who is doing the deal. And I need to ask somebody that I think I can trust, but I also need to ask somebody that I'm not going to try to run a game on. And that I probably can't run a game on because he knows me. He'll have seen it before, or she in women's case. And I need to ask him to be my sponsor. And then I need to do what I learned to do in that treatment center that night, is I need to be willing to hear what I don't want to hear. I need to make myself a blank slate and say, you know, I love this statement too. You know, I proved beyond a reasonable doubt that I could not do this life thing on my own. If I could have, I would have fixed myself before I got here. That shows me there's proof positive that I can't do it by myself. The very cool thing is I don't have to do it by myself. I've got you folks, and I've got a higher power that I found once I got here, which I'll talk about in a little while, to help me. And so what I learned to do was to start depending on a sponsor. My sponsor actually came to this clubhouse, and I came here for quite a while. Some of y'all may remember him. His name was Lawrence Potts. He unfortunately died of lung cancer, but he was a great, great guy. And he was famous in the meetings and people would say it along with him, like they kind of do the five things I talk about, which I will talk about in a minute. He would say after he shared either opening or closing, whatever he shared, he would say, "This is serious business." And he was right. I hear people talk in meetings a lot about the problem. And in good meetings, people talk about the problem, but they also talk about the solution. And I also hear people, you know, coming into meetings, especially newcomers, how bad things are. I want to talk for a minute how good things get. You know, my life today, you can't get here from where I started from. You just can't. And what I mean by that, I don't mean material stuff. I mean how I feel about me. And it's not ego stuff. It's not look at me, I'm cool. It's I'm comfortable in my own skin. I like who I am. I respect who I am. And that comes directly from what y'all taught me how to do and what to practice here. So I started going to meetings. I got a sponsor. And I started going to the men's workshops down at Rock Eagle. I've been to 29 of them in a row, I think. For the first year, I was in a meeting at least once every day, probably the first 2 years. How can I expect to learn this stuff if I don't immerse myself in it? So I'm going to talk about the five things that I heard in a meeting, nothing original to me, and it's just, I'll be very clear, it's just part of the recipe for what I think is a way to not only get clean, but to get sober, and I want to explain the difference in that. I've seen people come into meetings and come into recovery, and some people get considerable clean time, but they're not truly sober. And the difference is, for me, is that being clean is being absent of alcohol and drugs. Being truly sober is learning to be comfortable in my own skin, absent of alcohol and drugs, and not wanting to get high. It's a big difference. And it's my experience, unless I'm willing to do the five things I'm getting ready to say, I have zero chance of getting that. And those five things are, and I'll go through them quickly, and then I'm going to come backwards and break them down, is ton of meetings, competent sponsor, work all 12 steps, learn to pray, and work with others. Those are the five things. And I'll break them down now. The first one is going to meetings. As I said before, how can I expect to find a good sponsor and to become accountable and to hear enough stuff to where I can start looking at myself to see what changes? You know, I couldn't see this before I got to recovery, and some of the stuff sounds too simple, but it's not. And this one is, the world out there is not going to change. You know, my wife's going to be who she is. My job's going to be what it's going to be. My friends are going to be who they're going to be. Traffic is going to be what it's going to be. So if I want to be comfortable in that, and that I can't change that stuff. It's going to be what it's going to be. So if I want to be comfortable in my own skin in that, what's got to change? Me and the way I perceive all that stuff. And that's what recovery is a change in perception. And that's what the 12 steps give me. So coming in, work all 12 steps, get that competent sponsor. And then the key, the program is the 12 steps. This meeting tonight is the fellowship. It is not the program. It is a wonderful thing where I get exposed to the program, but the 12 steps, in my understanding, are the program. if I'm willing to take the steps with a competent sponsor, that what a competent sponsor is to me is somebody who's worked the 12 steps with a competent sponsor. His job is not to give me rides to meetings, to be my banker, to be my psychologist. His job is primarily to get me through the steps. And I shouldn't be the one to have to, if I've asked a sponsor to sponsor me, I've asked him because I want what he has. So if I want what he has, I need to go get it. It's not a sponsor's responsibility, in my experience, to call my sponsorees or to call a sponsoree. Even though I do sometimes, it's my job as a sponsoree to go get it, to call my sponsor. If I want what he has, I need to go get it. I've heard a lot of sponsorees through the years complaining about their sponsors, saying, well, they never call me. It's not their job to call me. It's my job to call my sponsor. So a good sponsor is going to get me through the steps. And I want to talk real briefly about, there's nowhere in the big book that it says we're supposed to go slow. It says when we work one step, we get that step, we go to the next one. When we finish that one, we finish the next one. I've heard through the years, people say a step a year or a step. You know, that's death for me if I had to wait that long. And how can I expect to learn to use the tools of the 12 steps until I've worked them? So I needed to give, and I did give, the 12 steps the time that it deserved. You know, working the 12 steps was the most important thing I was doing then and still is today. But so I always hear people talk about, you know, I've got work, I got this, I don't have time. You know, and it's like, how can I not have time? My sponsor gave me a good tool to use with that. He said, Bill, never met anybody in their life that can't find at least 30 minutes to work on something really important in their life during the day, no matter what they're doing. So he said, look at your day tomorrow. Find at least 30 minutes in your day, in your schedule. Make an appointment with yourself. Sit down, say a prayer. This especially goes for the fourth step. I'll get to that in a minute. But say a prayer. Let me do what I need to do then. And then sit down for at least 30 minutes and work on that. And then if whatever time I've given it, at the end of that, look at my day tomorrow. Find that at least 30 minutes, and then make an appointment myself and keep the appointment. And if I do that, there's no reason, like a four step should take more than 2 weeks, in my experience, if I give it the time that it deserves. So I can't expect to get the use of the tools until I work the 12 steps, and so I need to give it the time that it deserves. And I'll stay on that for a minute with the, you know, how many times have I seen three and out, three and out, three and out? That means work the first step, one, two, three, and then out. And here's my experience with that, is that people will come in, they will get, they're beat up, they're willing, they'll ask probably somebody to sponsor them, and then they're willing to work the first three steps. And usually a few days, weeks, or maybe a month has gone by, and they've worked those three steps, and they look around and, hey, the alcohol's out of my system. I might have a job back. My wife or husband might have me back in the house. I'm feeling physically better because I don't have that stuff in me. And they look around and they go, why do I need to do any more work? And invariably, and that goes back to that clean time thing. People can get clean time, but nothing changes if nothing changes. That old saying that you take a drunk jerk and you take the alcohol out of them, you still got a jerk. And the steps are really good at helping me with that stuff. So I need to work all 12 steps. There are tremendous gifts in that. Then, you know, the fourth one is learn how to pray. And that was a big sticking stone for me when I got here. I was my own higher power when I got here. And I didn't say, Bill, you're God, but I sure did treat the world like that. You know, I thought I'm very smart. I can handle the situations. And I deluded myself into thinking all that stuff. And all I had to do is look at my history just to show I wasn't God, and I certainly didn't handle things very well. So as the big book says, at some point in working the steps and talking with folks, I became willing not to have contempt prior to investigation. You know, I have a brother that's a minister, so you can imagine the conversations I had before recovery about God with him. You know, and it always came down to the word faith, doesn't it? Yeah, forget it. If I can't see it, touch it, smell it, taste it, forget it. And so I got into this and I realized maybe, you know, I became open to the idea that it was something greater than I was. And so at that point, I started looking for it working in my life. And there it was all the time. And So I became willing to do the things my sponsor suggested. And he suggested get on my knees and say the third step prayer. And the third step prayer, morning and night, is the basis for my morning prayers. And the third step prayer is a very cool prayer. It says, "Relieve me of the bondage of self." What I've been taught in this program, that the bondage of self is my character defects. My impatience, my tolerance, my dishonesty, my lust, my self-pity, self-condemnation. Those are really two good ones for newcomers, because I'm really good at beating myself up. So the bondage of self is my character defects, and that God's will for me is the living character qualities. And, you know, throughout my life, people have made spirituality, and this is a spiritual program, not a religious program. It's an inclusive program, not an exclusive program. I can choose the higher power of my own choosing. People throughout time have tried to tell me what I needed to believe, and I get to choose it here. So I started looking for it working in my life, and there it was all the time. So in the third step prayer, "Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will." And see if this makes sense to you. It did to me. If to the best of my ability, and I will not be perfect at this because I'm a human being and I still definitely make mistakes, but if to the best of my ability I live in character qualities towards everything that is put in front of me in the day, whether it's my job, all those things out there, wife, traffic, whatever. If I live in patience and tolerance and interest in others and honesty and all that stuff, to the best of my ability towards everything in my life, how can I not be living in God's will? So I keep it simple like that. I don't have to figure out if God's will is for me to go be a missionary in Africa or to do whatever. It's just simply for me to live in character qualities towards whatever is put in front of me in the day. And that's what the steps teach me. So take away my difficulties. What a great thing, but not for me. It's that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. May I live in character qualities always. You know, take away my difficulties. You know, I got here with the stuff, when I got here to the treatment center, I had a broken collarbone, a punctured lung. I was way past broke. I wasn't broke. I was way past broke. I was facing jail. I was facing loss of a professional license, and I thought I was never going to find somebody that would want to date me. And I'm going to talk about my fourth, and hopefully final wife. Anybody in here that's really struggling, newcomer, and they've had struggles with relationships, and they think, you know, with their history, they can't possibly find love or healthy relationship. Here's what happened to me. Through a series of getting sober, I've been sober for a while, I was able to walk into, I met a girl, healthy girl in recovery, fell in love with her, and so it was time to go talk to the parents. And I was actually able to walk into their house, and they got to know me a little bit, and say, "George and Helen, I'd like your daughter's hand in marriage, but by the way, I need to tell you I've been married 3 times and I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict." And today they love me. They look at me as a son. You know, it makes me tear up. So, you know, and all of my consequences are long gone from my being out there. So anybody that's struggling with consequences, if I suit up and I show up and I do what I'm taught to do here, all of my consequences will go away, and I can use them as an example to the next guy coming along. I want to talk about the second most useful tool I've learned in recovery. And the most useful is prayer. And the second one is projection, learning how not to project. And I'll explain how I learned this. I had gone and worked a recovery job and then was blessed to go back to work in my chosen profession, and which I'm a commissioned person, and so I don't get a check each week or each month unless I do something. And I was sitting second or third day back at my job at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was looking out the window, feeling the weight of all the money that I owed that I could not bankrupt. I could not bankrupt this. It was friends and family and stuff that I couldn't bankrupt. And so I was feeling miserable, feeling all that weight. So I called my sponsor. I said, "I'm feeling miserable. Here's what's going on." He said, "That's projection." And he gave me a definition. And the definition is anytime I'm in my thinking, worried about something in the future or in the past that I can do nothing about at this moment, not 10 minutes from now, not tonight, not next week, not tomorrow. If I can't do anything about it this moment, it is a useless, harmful exercise. I'm taught not to do it. And my experience is that 99.999% of the things that I project about, I still do it, don't ever turn out the way I think they are. They always seem to work out. And the example he gave me was, let's say that I had to have a job. I was out without a job, and I know new alcoholics can identify with that. I'm out of job. I got a family. Got to have money. And so, there's a difference between planning and projecting. Planning is a good thing. Projecting is not. Planning is what I can do. If I can do something positive about the situation right this second, I do it. And the example is, I've got to have a job, so I go out and do the footwork to get the interview. And so, an example, I've got an interview, and it's a week from now. Okay? And so the positive thing for me to do is every day continue to plan, which would be to continue to look for other jobs in case this one doesn't work out. But to do what I used to do would have been to, I've got this interview, I'm going to sit on my ass for a week, and I'm going to project, I've got to have this job. What happens if I don't get this job? So all that worry has no positive effect whatsoever whether I'm going to get that job or not. But it can have a definite negative effect on whether I get it. If I worry all week whether I'm going to get that job, how do you think I'm going to interview? I'm not even going to ask the question to see if I want the job. I'm probably going to take less money than I deserve. And I might probably won't get the job because I'm going to appear desperate. Conversely, if I say, in your will, if I'm supposed to have, I've done the work to get the interview, if I'm supposed to have a job, God, I'll get it. In the meantime, I'm going to keep looking for other jobs in case that one doesn't work out. Then I suit up and show up, say a prayer before the interview, and say, God, you know, if I'm supposed to have it, I'll have this job. If not, I'm not. The interview will go like it's supposed to go, and I'll either will or won't get that job. I love the term feeling the pain of something that hasn't happened yet. Anybody ever done that? If you didn't raise your hand, you're a liar. that's what projection causes. It causes me to feel the pain of something that hasn't happened yet. And again, 99.9% of things that I project about never happen. So I'm taught the tool is to put a little, I call them recovery switches, put a little switch in my head. And to start looking at my thinking and say, God, is this what I should be thinking? Or, you know, is this the right thing? Or am I worried about something in the future or in the past that I can do nothing about right now? And if I am, I need to take what I call a left turn. I love that term. Take a left turn with my thinking, which means to make myself think about something else. And what I'm supposed to think about is, what am I doing right now to make today better? And if I take a left turn after left turn after left turn and it still keeps coming back, the best solution to that is to call somebody else up, ask them how they're doing, and be interested. That doesn't mean call them up and say, how you doing? And they say, how you doing? Oh, man, it sucks. Life sucks. You know? No, it means, no, how you doing? And get them talking about them. And my experience is, I'm then out of me, and the problem's gone. So learning how to pray, you know, and I want to make the connection. I used to have real trouble with this spiritual stuff because it seemed too mystical to me. And so somebody taught me, or heard in a meeting, or just through practice, learned that I had to make a connection of what it really means. There's three ways I know to communicate with a higher power. And one is prayer, meditation. Two is meditation. Three is a conversational relationship with God. That's who I choose to call my higher power. And that's the one I use the most. If I want, in step two, it says, came to believe that a power greater than I am can restore me to sane thinking, sanity, which I believe is sane thinking. My God gave me free will, which is the ability for me to think and behave however I choose. So if I want, so he's not going to reach inside and change how I think. Maybe even though he's maybe capable of that, he won't do it because he gave me free will. He won't change how I think, or he won't change how I behave. So I need to make the connection. If I want a higher power to restore me to sane thinking and therefore action, step two and three, what have I got to do? I've got to talk to him. I'm getting ready to yell at my wife, God. Do you think I ought to? If I learn to ask the right questions, and then the key part is if I ask the right question and I get the answer, I need to be willing to do the next right thing. So it's common sense that if I say, God, should I give the money back at the Kroger checkout that they gave me too much change? And he says, yeah, it's common sense I do that. And that's where I start to build healthy self-esteem and healthy self-respect, which, again, what I was after when I got here and didn't know it. You know, as an addict, alcoholic and addict, I have always been after immediate gratification. And what I've come to learn that the long-term gratification of trying to do the next right thing, to being rigorously honest, telling the truth, treating people like I would want to be treated, gives me a feeling that is so vastly much more valuable to me than what I thought I wanted at that moment. The two areas that alcoholics, me especially, had a real tough time turning over. You know, I'll turn some of this stuff over to you, guy, but I want to hang on to finance and romance. You know, I want to buy what I want to buy, and I want to get laid when I want to get laid. And what I finally realized is that when I became willing to turn that stuff over is when my life truly became, I truly started to like who I was. I wasn't using other people. I wasn't using money to change the way I feel. So there's the higher power. And then working with others, whatever understanding I have of the 12 steps definitely came from working with a competent sponsor, but much more so working with a bunch of guys. When I sit and talk about steps 6 and 7, character defects, character qualities, and I explain what my understanding of the 12 steps are, what do you think it does for me? It helps me to continue to look at mine. It helps me understand the step a little better, and it reinforces my recovery. I love the term staying in the middle of the bed of recovery. And what that means to me, the illustration was, if you have a double bed and you're sleeping in the middle, if you have a little earthquake, you're going to roll a little bit, but you're going to stay in the bed. Well, if I'm not doing those five things, all five of those things, I'm sleeping on the edge of the bed. So if something rocks my world a little bit, I'm going to fall off into relapse. And relapse is definitely not a requirement of recovery. I'm going to say that again. It's definitely not a requirement of recovery. You know, I want to walk through a relapse. Let's have a little fun with this. Let's say that I was a very persuasive speaker. And I said, all right, guys, everybody, we're getting up, go out and get in the bus right now. And we're going to go somewhere and we're all going to go get high right now. After I took that first hit, after being here in a little bit of recovery, how am I going to feel? I would get that buzz or whatever I was looking for a minute or two or 5 or 10 minutes. Then what happens? My thinking goes, oh no, I've done it again. You know, I can't go home. My wife's going to leave me. I have to pick up another white chip. So if I make it back, so a good alcoholic I am, I don't want to feel that way. So what am I going to do? Do some more. I'm going to do some more and do some more and do some more until I've numbed it out, until I can't go anymore. Either I die, death, jails, or institutions, the big book says. And then if I'm lucky, I'll end up sitting right back here trying to do this thing again. So tell me what's fun about a relapse. My brain will tell me. I have a disease that talks to me. It's the only disease that I know of that tells me I don't have a disease. It tells me I'm okay. It tells me to be okay. I can do just one. Or I won't get caught, or the proverbial F it. And that's when I have to practice the step one perfectly. That's when I have to be in step one. And my understanding of that is I admitted I'm powerless over this stuff, and my life will become manageable. And what that means to me is that right now I've got 15 years today. I think that's just great. I mean, I can't believe it. But no. I'm stoked about that. That's just a pretty cool thing for me. Thinking of 15 years just boggles my mind. But I know that I have power today, right this minute, over whether I go drink or drug. I do. But what step one tells me is that once I put the first one in, I have no power over the second one, and the third one, and the fourth, and the rest of it. And then all I have to do is look at where I ended up to realize that my life will quickly become unmanageable. I do get to manage my life today with the help of God. You know, the big book talks about aligning my will with God's. I have a brain, and the way I align my will today to the best of my ability, and I'm very clear, I'm a human being, I make mistakes. But unlike before recovery, I don't beat myself up that much. I still feel the zinger. I call them zingers. Oh, that didn't feel good. You know, I made a mistake. I immediately today go into the solution, which is what you guys teach me. I say, all right, what can I learn about this so I don't make the same mistake again? And then I get into a character quality, which is self-forgiveness, because what use am I to anybody, myself or anybody else, if I'm sitting in self-pity and self-condemnation? No good at all. And then I forgive myself, and then I move on and get back into the solution. So So working with others, and working with others can mean setting up chairs. It can be making coffee. It can be speaking at a speaker meeting. It can be chairing a meeting when you get 90 days. It can be anything. Being a part of is a huge thing. So those are the five things that I think are, and you know, a good recipe for me. I check myself daily. You know, when I get up and say my third step prayer, I say, okay, am I doing the five things today? And that served me very, very well. And I'll be real clear again that in my experience, if I'm willing to do all five of those things, I have an incredibly good chance of getting and staying sober, not just clean. But if I'm not willing to do all five of those things, I have zero chance of getting truly sober and staying that way. So, and then how it is today, you know, I have a very successful business. I'm happily married for 10 years. I've got quality friends in my life, and I'll talk about friends for a second. You know, before recovery, I used to call people my friends, and I didn't use that word correctly because they really weren't my friends. They were using buddies. They were people that would put up with me while I was using and be reasonably nice about it. Today, I look at friendships, and I ask myself the question, why would I want to... I get to choose today who I spend my personal friend time with. Away from meetings, away from sponsorship, my social time, I get to choose who I spend that time with. Why would I choose to spend time with somebody who for even a fraction of a second I have to worry if they're telling me the truth, that they're going to lie to me, or that they're not going to show up when they say they are and at least call them to tell me why they couldn't make it, and they don't have a good sense of humor and they don't treat people like they would want to be treated? Why would I want to spend time with those folks? I've heard it said several different ways, but about people looking for a relationship. You know, and I've heard say, put out a piece of paper and write down every character quality, every trait you would like in that person of the opposite, of the mate you're going to have. And then ask yourself, do I have all those traits? Now, I want somebody who's trustworthy and honest and friendly and treats people like, and fiscally responsible, financially responsible, and shows up. I want all that stuff. Well, am I that stuff? So in recovery, I have found that sickness attracts sickness, and health attracts health. So if I give myself enough time to become who I'm going to become working this program, what I'm going to be attracted to will change, and what will be attracted to me will change, because I'm not going to be the same person I was when I walked in here right away. So, you know, there's a saying that says, until I don't need a relationship, I shouldn't be in a relationship. You know, my understanding is that healthy relationships are two spiritually fit people growing, and there's an attraction of the health. There's not a needy one and a non-needy one. And you know, I remember, you know, using people. You know, if I found a needy woman, I can, you know, she needs. I can give her something, and I can get something back, and it was just a sick relationship. It's just based on sickness, and what you get on a relationship based on sickness is what? A sick relationship. And so, you know, those are the five things. So, again, today I am very, very grateful that I have the friends that I have in my life. You know, the whole purpose of getting sober is to get out in the world and live. I've run into people who have been around for a long time, and all they do is stuff with other recovering people. And that's fine, but it's not for me, you know, because the point of getting sober is to get out and live life. And I have a lot of recovering friends, but I have a lot of friends today who are healthy human beings. They're not in recovery. Don't need to be in recovery. They're spiritually fit people that I do stuff with. So, and then getting out into work and doing that kind of stuff. So, I could talk for hours and hours on this stuff because I absolutely love this program. Trying to think if there's any other tools. There's a ton of tools that I've learned here. Not projecting is the biggest one. I hope you all will remember that. And it helps me when I talk about that stuff. It helps me remember to practice it. The last thing about projection is I still do it. You know, even though I have 15 years now of learning that it's a harm.
First I slept and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me and finally waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that set me free. Take me where the promise is.